Several months ago, Carrie Tennis, an advice columnist from Salon.com, responded to a letter from a woman complaining about her relationship with some savvy, though forgettable, advice about standing up for herself. But in the end, he penned the following statement. "Also," he said, "know that you are loved." That's the other part. You might not be loved by every skinny man under 30 with a tattoo and a Mets cap, but that's not what I mean. You are loved. You are part of a great and compassionate universe, and you are loved. No matter whom you sleep with, you sleep every night under a canopy of infinite heavens. And by the grace of unseen forces, you can often see the stars in these heavens and are held to the earth and oxygenated by the air and fed by the world of plants and animals and all of these miracles, the miracle of gravity, of quantum physics, of photosynthesis and respiration and cell division, all these laws and processes, all these mysteries only faintly described by math. All these things are forms of love. We are held together by all of this. All of us, dogs and cats and zebras and you and me. We crazy, arrogant creatures full of illusion and rage and self-pity are held by this stuff in an unshakable embrace. We are in it and of it. We belong to it. Its substance and ours is our substance. There is no difference between us and a star. This caught my imagination so much, it's been on my computer for several months now, waiting for the right time to incorporate it into a sermon. 2 days from now is Valentine's Day, a holiday devoted to cards, jewelry, flowers, chocolate, and other gestures of romantic love. Nice work if you can get it. But if you're alone, it can leave you feeling like the swan chick in the group of ducklings. Doesn't matter that you're going to grow up to be more beautiful than any of them. You just know that right now you don't fit in. My daughters came up with Artemis Day, a day to celebrate people who aren't in love, named after the famously single Greek goddess of the hunt. But for now, we're going to sidestep that entire question of earthly romance and go into a different genre of love. What does it mean to be loved by the universe? To rest and sink back into it and be held in the embrace of a benevolent universe? What does it do to our lives if we trust this, believe this, rest in this? Reverend David Bumba, who was one of my favorite professors at seminary, was a very young Universalist minister before the merger in 1961. He describes himself as an agnostic. He doesn't particularly believe in God, but he believes that it's important that we have some way of acknowledging those spiritual moments that many of us have. He describes it as the moment when you're walking the dog and you just have this instant, just for a moment, that you are a crucial yet ephemeral part of the universe, no greater or less than anyone or anything else. For the briefest instant, time seems to stand still, and you feel at one with the universe. For me, those moments happen fairly frequently, mostly out in nature, sitting alone on a beach watching the waves, camping, and that late night trip to the bathroom, no one else is awake, and the stars, oh, the stars, peeking out through the trees, filling the night sky, and we are made of the very same substance as the stars, and we are minuscule in comparison, and yet we breathe and think and move in the world of our own free will. Damn, I love those moments. And I often wonder what accident of biology or evolution or God or wonder made us hardwired to notice beauty. Why is it that we see the stars or a forest or a sunset and stop and breathe in awe and wonder. How lucky are we that the way the light rays divide and ricochet off particles and molecules in the air at the moment the sun sinks below the horizon creates something that our brains register as beautiful. I don't know why this is. Though I am reminded of something that Benjamin Franklin once said about beer. He said, "Beer is proof that God loves us and wants us to be happy." There's that line in the novel The Color Purple by Alice Walker, where Shug says to Celie that God gets pissed off if we walk by the color purple in a field and don't notice. "Everyone wants to be loved and appreciated," says Shug. "Ever notice how trees do everything we do to get attention except walk," she says. So if we acknowledge those moments of deep, deep interconnectedness, if we admit or understand that we are part of a process, part of the universe's quest to understand, to make meaning, to know and be known, what then? What does it mean for ourselves, for our world, and for our understanding? First, I believe that we are called by this understanding to work to protect the planet and to protect our communities. This is a this-world theology. We are not merely biding time here, waiting for the real existence to take place in the next world. This is all we know. We may trust that there is some meaning that we don't understand, but we realize that this here and now is the only place that we have to do the work of tikkun olam, repairing the world. We are called to seek not our welfare alone, but the welfare of the whole, according to Bamba, to serve life in perpetuity. This theology doesn't mean that nothing bad will happen. It's strange, although the idea of intelligent design is a theory that has been used by religious conservatives to advocate an alternative to evolution, I confess that on some level the idea is one that sort of resonates with me. I don't know that there's an omnipotent being out there who wound the world and then let it go, free to make its own mistakes. But that idea really isn't all that far removed from a universe that is evolving from disorder to order, from simplicity to complexity, from singularity to multiplicity. I believe that there is a meaning in evolution that we haven't grasped yet, that the universe is evolving in an intelligent fashion, creating more complex and interdependent systems, moving towards wholeness. So what does it mean? As I understand it, the universe has been set up to function in a particular way. The planet strives to remain in balance. Either the lions eat the antelopes, or the antelope multiply to the point where they eat all the fauna and then starve. After millions of years of a relatively stable population, humanity has shifted the balance radically with our ability to cure diseases and infections and our ability to feed ourselves with a system where only a small percentage of people are involved in the production of food. Time will tell if this is a sustainable system. At the moment, projections indicate that global warming will have profound effects on the landmass that supports the population, but we don't know what will happen. What seems clear to me personally is that accidents, death, personal tragedies, and the outcome of Super Bowl games is not something preordained by an omnipotent God or subject to capricious whims based on who prayed harder. I can't believe in a God that causes car accidents that kill parents leaving their children orphaned as part of some master plan to bring people closer to itself. I don't believe in a deity that decides who lives and who dies or who wins and loses based on accidents of birth and location. But I can believe in a universe that comes with certain rules of physics and biology, where a contraption of steel hurtling through space at 60 miles an hour collides with another such contraption driven by someone who's been drinking and crosses over the median and hits the first contraption head on. Physics means that this force, this acceleration plus mass, is going to have serious consequences on our fragile bodies. And I believe that natural variations lead to genetic anomalies, the kind that lead to diabetes and cancer and Down syndrome. I believe that humans have overcome some of these in our quest to understand and our quest to conquer early death. We now have insulin, which blessedly saves diabetic children. I believe that there is a point where our compassion needs to conquer our desire to fix things, and we need to understand some variation as normal and not needing to be fixed. And we realize what there is to learn from people with certain types of deviations from the norm. We've come a long way from the time when infants born with physical problems were left out to die, but we have a long way left to go in accepting and understanding people with other types of differences. Aside from genetic variations, I wonder how many other problems are a result of the universe's drive toward order. What relevance do spikes in things like autoimmune diseases and food allergies and autism have? Is there a canary in the coal mine meaning behind these, indicating that we are out of balance again? We've moved miles away from the way humans evolved in terms of how our food is grown, the chemicals we use, and what we spend our time doing. This has been the cause and the result of both human flourishing and human hubris. Such a miracle it is that individuals can choose so many things about their lives. We can choose what to study, what to spend our working life focusing on, whom to love, whether to marry or not, or raise children or not. Girls, and not just boys, can now be educated and work for pay and make choices about their families. But there is still an incredible dichotomy between rich and poor, between those who have more money than they could possibly know what to do with, and those who go to bed hungry. This dichotomy exists across hemispheres, across continents, and within individual communities. It is wrong, it is unjust, and it is eventually unsustainable. And yet I still believe that the universe bends towards justice, towards flourishing, towards benevolence. What does that mean? How does it change me to have that belief? It means I don't worry quite as much as I might. It means I do what I can. I take responsibility for paying my bills and taking care of my children. But it also means that I choose to see the good in people. I choose to believe that I can be part of that goodness. It means I move through the world believing that my actions have value and can make a difference. It means I trust that I have agency in my own life. Things don't just happen to me. I have some control over parts of it. It means I am held by a power greater than myself and that I choose to trust in that. It means I can count on my friends and my family and my community to sustain me. It means I know that I have a safety net that will not let me fall. Yes, there is a certain amount of privilege in this belief. Happiness is in part based on a certain minimal level of having enough food, water, shelter, safety. These basic needs must be met before we can think about happiness. And yet, once these basic needs are met, keeping up with the Joneses decreases happiness. Statistics show that people who aren't striving for more stuff but instead are living in an attitude of being grateful, are the happiest people. When we compare ourselves with others is when we tend to get dissatisfied. The Atlantic Monthly magazine ran a wonderful article many years ago on the difference between red states and blue states. One of the central questions of the article was why people who were of lower socioeconomic status would vote for Republicans and thus vote against their own economic interests. The answer that the author came up with was that folks in more rural areas don't feel poor because they have the money to buy what's available there. They don't compare themselves unfavorably with their neighbors because they have enough money to purchase what's available in their area. If you can afford to eat at the nicest restaurant in town for a birthday dinner, even if that's Red Lobster, you don't feel less than. It's this urban culture where we have all of these things that most of us can't touch that makes us feel like we don't have enough. But what does that have to do with trusting in the universe? If I trust in the universe, truly not in some New Age hokey kind of way, but in an I need to do my part, but the universe will hold me kind of way, then I don't think the universe will answer all my desires. My football team might not win. I might not get the latest gadget. But I will move through life feeling grateful for the beauty around me, noticing the interconnectedness of life, and behaving as if I am grateful. The surest way to have what you want is to want what you have. What I want is to move through life happy and relaxed, caring for those I love, engaging in meaningful work, grace, gratitude, awe, and wonder. Mira, a 16th century Indian Hindu poet, wrote, "I know a cure for sadness. Let your hands touch something that makes your eyes smile." I bet there are 100 objects close by that can do that. Look at beauty's gift to us. Her power is so great that she enlivens the earth, the sky, our soul. Our knowledge of the universe is increasing at an exponential rate. Universalism used to mean that God was too good to damn anyone to hell, and too big to be contained in the context of only one religion. Perhaps now the very universe itself holds us in love. Perhaps what we perceive as beauty or truth or the sacred mystery of God is in fact the very demonstration of that universal love. How would you live if you believed that to be true? Go do it. Blessed be, and amen.